From KQED Public Radio, this is the Capital Notes podcast, the last one of the year.
Ever.
No, of the year.
Ever.
Ever? You're not going to do it anymore?
Of the year.
Well, then I got a replacement for you who's
sitting
on the other
side
of the studio.
Hi there.
Yeah, I see on the other side of the studio. I'm John Myers from KQED Public Radio. The guy who says he's not coming back is Anthony York, the editor of Capital Weekly.
I'm not coming back this year.
And we needed help to recap the year that was. So, Juliet Williams.
Hello.
Capital reporter for Associated Press.
She's here. My first ever podcast.
Yeah. Congratulations.
Thanks.
You will find that it's such a stimulating experience.
Let the hazing begin.
Uh-oh.
Oh, no, good. What fun. We make her sorry that she agreed to come in to talk about the year. So, this is the year-end podcast. We won't be back until the budget's back in January at some point.
Did the budget ever go away?
No, and that's kind of the problem. That's kind of the... Yeah, we were sitting here talking about what we were going to talk about on the podcast, and all we could come up with for the year that was 2009 really was the budget.
Well,
budget.
Five different incarnations of the budget.
And variations of budget theme stories and budget.
All of them involving a $20 billion deficit.
Or more.
And a chronic inability to actually fix it.
See, I know why we brought Juliet in. Yeah. She sounds smart. She's not just like prattling about like Anthony and I do every time. Obviously, if you talk about the year in California politics and here in the state capital, you have to talk about the budget problem yet again, the saga that never goes away, the $42 billion deficit fix in February. I had to write all this down. The $25 billion deficit fix in July, another $21 billion problem come the end of this year, beginning of the new fiscal year, and on and on and on and on. So did it feel like it was a long year of budget coverage, or is it just me?
No, it's not just you. I think it's everybody. And it's not going away.
Did we learn anything from this? I mean, did anything really – not learn anything. Let me rephrase it. Did anything fundamentally change? Did the dynamics fundamentally change of why we keep having budget problems? I mean, and we know it was exacerbated by the economy this year. But as we end on December 31st, looking from January 1st, did the dynamics of this budget drama change at all?
I don't think so.
No?
I think the players changed, the big numbers changed, the cuts changed, and a lot of people felt like they took it on the chin, but here we are again.
But the same dance over and over and over, you think?
It felt like it to me.
The only thing that may have changed, and this remains to be seen depending on what happens next year, is the public's tolerance for this stuff. I mean, you now have two separate movements, at least, aimed at large-scale structural reform of the budget. This is something that people have tried, right? The governor tried this in 2005, didn't go very well. His piecemeal reforms, his special election in May was his latest failed attempt at making some structural changes. And now there are a couple of groups out there that are trying to tap into public frustration with this process to make those changes. And whether those come to fruition and anything comes of that, remains to be seen.
Well, the two you're referring to are one group called California Forward, which has a systemic number of changes, incremental changes, I guess you'd call it, of ballot measures that they would put forward.
Correct.
And a group called Repair California, which is talking about a constitutional convention. But I would also throw in there, they're also the wild cards, like the group trying to pass a part-time legislature initiative.
Yeah.
That's not as far-reaching of the way that the budget works, but it's certainly a reaction to people being pissed off about the way things happen up
and
there.
And there's a two-thirds vote out there, too, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The modification of the two-thirds vote, which is being pursued as well.
It's true. People are really frustrated. I was out just trying to talk to regular people, as we call them.
Are there any of those in Sacramento?
There are, apparently.
Not
if you go to the mall.
To
but I was surprised because these are people that are not involved in this insular world. And universally, they were just frustrated and angry in a way that, you know, people always hate politicians in one way or another. But they were just fed up about it. And so maybe these guys will get some steam next year.
Perhaps. Or we could be talking about the next failed year in budget reform.
Yeah.
But it is a question of what has changed inside the building. I think now the legislature feels the threat of these reform movements out there, and that's, you know, whether or not it'll scare them into action. You know,
they're talking reforms themselves, but it remains to be seen whether they can do some of it internally.
But in the short term, I mean, look, some combination of spending cuts and revenue increases are going to have to be passed.
Ooh, again. You sound like a Democrat.
Who were the
No. I mean, whether you call it a fee or a tax or whatever, I mean, I can't imagine that, you know, or if you can either do that or put it off with accounting gimmicks again, you know, trumping up the sale of the state compensation insurance fund, which everyone knew wasn't going to happen. Right?
Well, but, let's talk about the fact that this year saw the first actual tax increase in years. In California, as part of a budget deal, a true tax increase. I mean, we could debate what other things were taxes or not, really, to the average person. But a sales tax increase, an increase in the car tax, and all the other little fun things about withholding, and all the other little games about your income tax schedule. And I'm sitting here trying to think. I mean, we know that there are lots of losers out of this. I mean, there were people who care about programs and depend on those programs that were losers in 2009. I would argue the Democrats in the legislature were largely losers in 2009 because, I mean, they continued to agree to cuts and didn't quite get all the taxes I think they would have liked or some of the changes.
And those taxes go away next year.
Right. Yeah. But I was going to say the only winner I see is Arnold Schwarzenegger. Politically
How's
speaking.
That again?
Yeah.
Well, is that 19% approval rating?
No, because I think he came out of it. I don't think he came out of it any worse or better. I mean, I don't think he came out of it any worse. I know it's a stretch. Go with me here. But he got, I mean, look at it this way. In February, he demanded an 18-month package solution. He got an 18-month package solution. Now he'd lost the special election, which we need to talk about in a moment, as all of them did lose the special election for the taxes and all the other stuff. He pretty much got the package he wanted in July. I don't really think he gave in on anything major in July in that $25 billion deal. He got the, I think what he got as a long lasting reform is he got the elimination of those automatic cost of living increases in the July budget deal that have been part of the general fund spending plan for years. I mean, it's not a huge victory. I'm not saying people are going to walk around, you know, praising him for what a great year he had. But I think he lost less than Democrats
maybe
in the Capitol and Republicans in the Capitol.
Maybe that's the best way to put it. Is he lost less. Because I think he comes out of it bruised. You're right. Yeah. He didn't suffer, but he didn't really get to achieve any of the things that he set out to do.
He's
only got a year left now, and he hasn't accomplished really any of the grand scale things he had hoped for.
Anthony's not buying any.
No, I just, you know, I mean, that said, I mean, the budget ball is now back in his court, right? So, I mean, what is the next step? I mean, he came out last, well, the 07-08, whatever that was, the last budget cycle never really ended. Remember, the legislature was sworn in December. They were voting on a budget plan within a week or two.
End of 2008, right?
And this rolled through to February, and then again in the summer. So now in January, looking ahead, the governor's going to have a more traditional budget unveiling. He's not going to do it on New Year's Eve like he did last year. And the ball's in his court. I mean, is he going to call for revenue increases? This is his last budget. Right, this is his last year in office, and this is a governor who is hyper aware and concerned about his legacy and his public image.
Exactly.
So what, you know, what will, I mean, I think that's sort of one of the big questions for 2010 is what will the lasting image, political image of Arnold Schwarzenegger be, and how will the governor act to try to shape that? Will he try to push for revenue increases, for tax increases again, to extend the existing tax increases, to repeal some of the tax breaks that were passed, that there's now a ballot initiative in circulation that could revoke some of these tax breaks for large corporations. So the
problem is the longer that this budget thing dragged out, I mean, that made 2009 virtually impossible for him to focus on anything else, anyone to focus on anything else. So
yeah.
I think that hurts his political legacy and makes it extremely difficult for him to get anything beyond that.
But I also wonder, I mean, you know, and let's use the way you framed it, Anthony, about like what he might do in 2010. I mean, I think there's a school of thought that says that in 2010, he tries hard to not spend a lot of his time in the public eye on the budget and try to get all these other things to cement the legacy.
Sure, reform, he tries that.
Reform issues that we're going to hear about in the State of the State speech.
The
open primary that he campaigns for, the water bonds on November, anything to divert the attention away from what I think a lot of reporters, and myself included, would think it really is his legacy, which is the state's financial problems. That's what the recall was all about.
Right. That's right. You're just going to ignore it.
But the problem is he has to, again, work with an intransigent legislature and finagle all this. And with all the gimmicks that they put in last year, we're back at the same place again. So can he change the conversation away from that if they don't solve it?
Fair to say that one of the low points of 2009 for all of them was the special election, was the just total belly up of the special election.
Absolutely.
I mean, that was just a and you have to wonder, too, we've all played armchair Monday morning quarterback. Can you say armchair on Monday morning in the same phrase?
You can be in an armchair on Monday morning.
Yeah, sure. I'm often sitting in the armchair on Monday mornings. But, we all played that afterwards and wonder whether it was just a too clever by half kind of move, and or that it was just, it was the kind of thing that it just made the unholy alliance of the people who care about social service programs line up arm in arm with the anti-tax groups, and everybody found something to hate. And but that had to be one of the real low points for all of them, that they just totally miscalculated what the voters would do. I mean, they got nowhere.
I think it was felled by some of the same problems that they might confront with the water bond. Trying in seeking compromise, they threw a little bit of everything in there and gave everyone something to hate. And
we've been hearing for years about a potential, putting the budget on the ballot. That's essentially what this was.
Right.
At least the takeaway, if you talk to folks in the Capitol, they say the message they got was the people want us to do our job.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure if you go back to our podcast in May, we probably discussed that a little bit. Whether or not that's true, if that is the real takeaway and the lesson of the special election. I mean, I think one of the interesting things about that election is, and something to watch in this next budget cycle, is the role of organized labor and sort of the split between the teachers' unions and the service employees union. You now see sort of fighting over scraps. I mean, the teachers union has a locked in percentage of the budget reserved for them under Proposition 98, and now you're seeing other public sector unions fighting on everything, whether it's the special election initiatives. Or we're seeing pushback now on the bond indebtedness that that unions don't want the water. They're going to come out against the water bond because
it takes money from other programs.
Because it takes general fund money to pay the interest on that debt, and it takes money away from programs. So I think that those sort of core tensions that we saw bubble over in May and in this weird alliance between the unions and the taxpayer groups, that some of those dynamics are still going to be in play in 2010.
The other thing I always think about, too, about that special election is that this calculation that was made, and we were all there in the dead of night in February when they made the calculation to link the tax increase to the budget reform proposal, to the spending limitation in that proposal, that they all thought, well, that's the only way to pass it. Well, in fact, what that was is that was the single worst thing for anybody who says that maybe you do need some kind of constraint on the way, elected officials, the legislature, spends money. It's hard to see a spending limitation get back on the ballot. That seems like it was their last best chance for a while.
I think if it had been straightforward and the voters knew clearly what was going on, I think they just felt the same sort of frustration that they feel with what the guys in the building do is that you're trying to trick us. You're not being straight up about everything that's in this package.
I guess I say that because if you look back to the last spending limitation that was on the ballot, which was 2005, which was Prop 76, it was beaten back by the teachers, by the CTA.
Mm-hmm. Right.
CTA was basically having to go along with Prop 1A on the May ballot because they wanted the money for Prop 1B, and the two were linked. I guess what I'm saying is that you go back to the ballot again, you do it as a free-floating limitation on spending. You don't have those political deals that were made. I mean, that may have been the opportunity to sideline the CTA and all of that money that they showed they could beat back something with Prop 76. I mean, I don't know.
Yeah.
Never say never.
That's a good point.
But I think a lot of people who believe in spending limitations, and again, this is an Arnold Schwarzenegger legacy issue, have got to wonder, was that a miscalculation on his part to let that play out the way it did, to put the taxes in there, to let it be beaten back by all the people who normally support spending limitations.
The other thing about that election, just from like an image political standpoint, is remember the do you remember the ads for those initiatives?
But of course.
Me neither. it was a fireman, you know, playing catch with his son,
there
right?
Was a or whatever,
a teacher. Yeah, there was a notable absence, and this sort of goes back to what we were talking about earlier. I mean, Arnold Schwarzenegger could not be in those ads because he was so unpopular. And he loved, right? That's the stuff he loves. He loves being the pitch man and the, you know, and the, sort of the salesman for California. And
Count Cartaxilo. No.
oh, yes. That's the Decade in Review podcast.
Yes, but go ahead.
But without that ability, I mean, I think it shows some of the limitations, not only of the governor, but of the attitudes that people have towards Sacramento in general. And, mm-hmm. and you know, and the confidence or lack of confidence that people have that folks here can actually fix the mess we're in.
And since then, their numbers have only dropped, which doesn't bode well for any of their measures next year, if they're going to pitch them.
So then I will put forward the only person who really is a real winner. And now I'm revising my statement where I said Arnold Schwarzenegger was a winner, because I agree with Juliette. I think you made the point. He lost the least, I would argue, out of those groups when you look at that, out of that. I mean, he still lost, though. The only real winner, Abel Maldonado.
Absolutely.
Yeah. State Senator from Santa Maria.
That guy knows how to play a game.
And I don't want to take away credit from him. I mean, maybe he had a chess game laid out where he knew what step he was going to take. But I think some of this just was serendipity,
checkers.
Just turned his way.
I think it was more checkers than chess.
Yeah. I mean, so, you know, so here's a guy in February who we know is a must vote for that budget deal, that tax increase, one of the 27 in the Senate. Only two Republicans voted for it, Abel Maldonado and...
Was it Roy Ashburn?
Roy Ashburn.
My mind's
good work.
A blur.
Thanks, Anthony. March,
yeah. I know. Anthony had this look of panic when I tried to pull that out of his head today. It's all that eggnog you drank last
That's
night.
What it was. That's what it was.
But so Maldonado knew he was a key vote and got everything he could have possibly gotten for that vote. I mean, you know, talk about a person who you know, it's almost like you're going through the store, like as a, and going, I want that, and I want that.
Absolutely.
Oh, wait a minute, did I mention that?
So,
like Ben Nelson.
Right, I was going to say, he's the Ben Nelson of the legislature, or Ben Absolutely. Nelson is the Abel Maldonado of the legislature.
So what he did is he was able to knock off some of the tax increases that he was not going to vote for, and that's a key element, too, because that pushed some of the deficit problems into the coming year. They could have had more
so
tax
So we can
revenue.
Blame Abel Maldonado next year.
And that's a thing that Arnold and Abel wouldn't have agreed on, even though Arnold says they're soulmates these days as the lieutenant governor designate. But so Abel Maldonado beat back some of those taxes. He got the open primary on the June ballot, or it's really a top two primary.
But he was fortunate because that's something that the governor supports already.
Yeah, exactly.
The governor
he went
wanted
to lunch
that
with
too.
The governor and struck that deal. I feel like there was something else, but those were the two.
Well, he
most
got
obvious
tapped
things.
As lieutenant governor.
Well, no, but yeah,
there was that too.
In February, okay. and then runs the table at the end by getting tapped as the governor's choice for the next lieutenant governor when John Garamendi went to Congress. And we don't know how that'll play out in 2010. We could make that prediction part at the end of the podcast, but
ooh, predictions.
But clearly, I mean, the guy was a winner. I mean, and. I don't know.
How about Gavin Newsom, big winner, because he doesn't have to be governor next?
Well, I was going to talk about Gavin Newsom. But anyway, I mean, you know, in just pure politics sense, we all agree, I guess, right? Abel Maldonado, we give you the crown.
He came out a winner. I don't know what it does for the rest of us, given the negotiations that they had to work out on the budget. But yeah, politically, he played it.
And it does show how when you get to that two-thirds vote, you know, You really do. You start the horse trading can get intense.
Absolutely.
And that's really that's the biggest I mean, it's obviously one of the biggest examples of horse trading in a long time, but it's the first time we've seen real horse trading for a vote in a while. I mean, you think about those budgets
in an obvious way like that.
Think about the Gray Davis budgets where he had to cobble together Republicans and he got, you know, Mike Briggs in Fresno and he got this and, you know,
Mike
I can
Briggs.
Know the list and look. You know, but picked off a few Republicans to vote for the budget. We hadn't seen that for several years. It was a different dynamic. It was more of a collective Republicans don't want, I don't know, they want school bus contracting. I can't even remember. CEQA reform.
Right.
Et cetera, et cetera. This was the first now, like, you know, individual members going off cutting a deal.
Roy Ashburn feels burned. What did he get?
Well, I don't know. We'll wait and see what appointments come down the pike next year.
It's not over yet.
But you know, but it's worth noting that February budget negotiation, or whatever you want to call that, melee, cost both Republican leaders their jobs. I mean,
yeah.
Dave Cogdill was a Senate Republican leader, got tossed out right in the middle of the negotiation and replaced with Dennis Hollingsworth.
Middle of the night.
And then Mike Vallines ultimately was a casualty. I mean, it took him a couple of months to actually be, I don't know, escorted out of office. But it cost Vallines his job, too. And it just shows the sort of divide over tax increases. I mean, that vote for tax increases, which, you know, is not forgotten among the Republican base. We saw recall attempts sprout up in the wake of this. I mean, none of them seem to be going anywhere. But the anger that brought up among the Republican base, I think it's going to make it difficult. It's present in the mind of Republicans in the Capitol, and it's going to make it that much harder to get a tax increase through this year,
and that much harder on the budget negotiations in general,
because they're
running out of options.
And I wonder too if there's not a lasting element of that, just to kind of put a wrap on it for a moment. If we've seen that kind of frustration and anger in the caucuses of Republicans in the Capitol, in the Senate, the Assembly, and the, you know, I think there's a pent up and not quite pent up anymore boiling over anger and frustration among Democrats in those caucuses,
especially in
the Assembly, where they feel as though they got taken to the cleaners. You know, a lot of those Democrats came up and felt like, in their words, they gave, they cut, and the Republicans still wouldn't give them what they argued was enough to be a balanced budget approach. And you saw that, I think, with Karen Bass as a speaker having a difficult time with that caucus. I think that was a hard caucus to corral this year in the Assembly, and they were still somewhat all kind of over the place when they chose a new speaker at the end of the year. So
yeah, and it'll be interesting to see what the House looks like under new leadership, and then, you know, if there's a new Assembly Republican leader, if Maldonado is confirmed, and then Sam Blakeslee runs for Maldonado's Senate seat.
If.
Right. Well, that's the 2000. That's the prediction part, right?
Yeah, we're not there yet. We're almost there.
I didn't even know that was coming. I've got to think of some quickly.
Just ahead.
But the personalities are significant in these budget discussions. And, you know, we had three new leaders in the Big Five this year. And we've already got one, a new speaker, designate to be whatever that is. And perhaps another new person in the Assembly Republican leader's chair. I mean, that changes the dynamic as well. So it should be fun.
It should be
fun.
All right. Well, so really quickly, another person that I wanted to talk about staying away from the budget for just a moment. God forbid.
We do get next year to talk about it again.
Yeah.
So
yes,
talking about something other than the budget, talking about the brewing race for governor, which of course will play itself out completely in 2010. But we had a lot of maneuvering in 2009. Big story. Gavin Newsom not making it to 2010, deciding he wasn't going to run about it. You referenced it a moment ago.
Oh, yeah.
Just fizzled out?
It wasn't just Gavin Newsom. Remember, before Newsom got into the race, Antonio Villaraigosa, mayor of Los Angeles.
That's true. That was 2009
Decided not to get in.
It was a long year.
It was a long year. And I think, you know, the common thread, and when you look at both of those guys, is Jerry Brown.
Just single-handedly cleared the field without even announcing. His name ID just goes beyond anyone's ability to raise money to compete.
But then there's something, too, about, I mean, you know, there was a lot of stories about, you know, the Newsom campaign. Was it really on track? Did Newsom have his heart in raising the money? And, you know, even though I think a lot of political writers wanted to see the generational battle, the younger Gavin Newsom attracting the younger Democrats in the party, the generational divide of Jerry Brown, the familiar Democrat. I mean, we obviously didn't get that wish. But in other words, how much of it was Brown clearing the field and how much of it were these guys just saying my heart's not in it? Villaraigosa, too, who was having troubles in his personal life and people wondering about where his leadership was in L.A.
I think that may have been the final nail in the coffin for Villaraigosa, the personal life scandals coming out, because that was one more obstacle to overcome. And he couldn't start raising money until after the L.A. mayor's race, so he was already kind of behind financially.
Yeah, and Newsom sort of represented the shiny object. I mean, one thing we didn't talk about in this year in review, this was certainly in the Capitol, this was the year that thanks to you, John Myers, the year of Twitter. Twittering.
Thanks, John.
I don't really think I take the blame.
Thanks
for
well, one I, other of, thing of the budget to process, limit my the budget process.
Oh, you love Twitter too, you at no, Capital was, Weekly guy.
Eating your Twitter
you
dust.
At Jay Williams. Are you Jay Williams AP?
I am.
You're
yes.
Jay Williams AP.
Maybe I'll
for
get
Twitter.
A couple more followers.
But we're all
now.
Forced because of you.
Yeah.
At @KTD_CapNotes.
Started tweeting in February.
But go ahead. Make stuff. Your point. I'm sorry. But
that Gavin Newsom sort of represented, you know, the shiny object. He had 1 million followers on Twitter. He had, was it Wyclef play? Some
Wyclef Jean.
Yeah.
You know, play. So, and yet, you know, on
that was
on
at the
basic
state Democratic
stuff,
convention. You shorthanded
up here
it, still,
in Sacramento. Yeah. You know, all of his Facebook campaign that he was running. And when it came to the basics of running a political campaign, the good old-fashioned kind of blocking and tackling, to use the football metaphor, just couldn't compete. And so I think it shows some of the limitations of new blood, of some of the new toys and the new gimmicks in this current situation. And, you know, it'll be interesting to see how the messages of the Whitman and Poisner and Brown campaigns begin to gel, and the Campbell campaign as well.
All right, but I don't disagree with you completely, but I just want to add another thing. I mean, couldn't part of the Newsom story, and I mean, in the end, I still do think with Newsom and Villaraigosa, there's an element of they just in some way weren't ready to do what it took to try to go after to go after Jerry Brown. But in part of the Gavin Newsom story has got to be that he was going to start with a disadvantage called San Francisco same-sex marriage. And
absolutely.
That he was going to have to sell himself to the rest of the state on that. He was going to have to overcome that obstacle. Brown, in addition to the name ID, is Attorney General of the state of California. It's a great platform. He can be tough on crime. He can run the
sure.
bad guys out.
It was all Newsom, those things.
Newsom,
made...
But Newsom was going to have to come over that hurdle in addition to all the other hurdles. And I mean,
on the illegal immigration issue where you had a
sanctuary city issues.
Right.
I mean, all those things that weren't going to necessarily play well in those parts of California where they're either moderately Democratic or not Democratic at all. So who knows?
Well, that was another big story. Was that 2000? No, that was 2008.
Yeah. Don't go
the gay marriage, the gay marriage story.
That was November 2008.
Yeah, that was 2000.
Though it may come back in 2010, in 2010.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he was spending a lot of time in the Valley, and I think he was prepared to put in that work. Whether he could have overcome it, I don't know. Maybe they looked at it and saw that he couldn't. But I talked to a lot of sort of Dem strategists after he bowed out, and they just said, look, we have a robust field. They're just not – 2010 is just not the year. With Jerry, I mean,
do you think that's true, or do you think they're spinning you? Because I have had other people ask me, where are all the Democrats in California? If you're going back to
Jerry
Brown.
Well, that's what I started. That was my question that I started with. And they, you know, they pointed to Kamala Harris. I mean, there are, but some of them are clearly not ready. They're not at the level of running for governor. But the estimate was 15 to 20 million that you need to raise just to get a campaign to fight Jerry Brown's name ID. That's not even the campaign fighting.
Right.
And he's just rolling in money right now.
Another name, another person who just doesn't have the sort of, if it's a fire in the belly issue, who does have the resources and does have a platform to run, but is just, and I think would like to be governor, is Bill Lockyer, the state treasurer.
Mm-hmm.
Here's a guy
who's sitting
is,
on about half of that amount that Juliette mentioned probably right now, $6-7 million.
Which is about how much Jerry Brown has in the bank.
Yeah.
And just doesn't, you know, Lockyer has sort of become the scold now, you know, wagging his finger at the legislature this year. And
that's been fun.
Cracking down. Yeah, that's been good.
It's like the only guy. Yeah, it's the only guy in the room telling it like it is.
You know, I mean, and I think that sort of reputation as being the kind of, you know, the California version of the Straight Talk Express, right? But you know, but I think it says a lot about what campaigns have become now. I mean, the idea of going on television and there's so much image and so much showbiz involved in running a statewide campaign in California. That's why we see Meg Whitman on the radio now.
You can see her on the radio?
Yes, I see her on the radio.
She's picking up from you.
Great. I see how this is working.
Yeah. Your smart-ass vibe is falling over the studio here. But I mean, there's a lot of showmanship. I mean, that's what you're saying. And also, you have to start very early. I mean, you know, Whitman with all of her money
early.
To get her name ID up as a Republican who's never run, as the you know, former CEO of eBay and was a surrogate for John McCain, but that didn't really work in the rest of California. She had introduced herself, and the polls show that that has worked. I just want to walk backwards just for a moment. Watch. Sorry.
See, watch on the
pantomime
right.
in the studio. Juliet, you wrote a piece near the end of the year that I think did start to address one of the things that I know we've talked about, and certainly the last poll from PPIC I thought had some tea leaves in it, which was about Democrats really being excited about Jerry Brown or not. And,
right.
and you got the sense that there was some hand-wringing. I think the poll certainly, you know, it's an early poll, and the Brown folks quickly called me and told me that that wasn't the case. But, I mean, you know, there are people who wonder which Jerry Brown shows up. I mean,
absolutely.
The nine lives of Jerry Brown, sometimes he's liked the Democratic Party. Sometimes in his life he has criticized the Democratic Party. Some of the positions he's taken as attorney general don't make some rank-and-file liberal Democrats feel so great.
And he's already signaled that he is going to not support tax increases, that he's going to make that part of his campaign. So, yeah, there's a lot of progressive, moderate Dems who are not happy that that's what they're left with at this early stage. And even, I think, among Dems who really like Jerry Brown, they want him to get going already. This whole let's play coy about whether I'm going to run or not was fun for a while. But I think now they're at the point like, okay, can we get going? Can you start campaigning? You've got right. the money. When is this happening?
Do you think there's any impact at all, either of you? Do you think there's any impact if there is a not robust love for him among some Democrats that impacts any of that work to get him elected, especially if he doesn't have any primary competition? It's an awful long,
it
time,
is a long time
for the Republicans to take wax at him running for that June primary battle between Whitman, Poisner, Campbell.
It's not just the Democrats. You look at that PPIC poll. I mean, the numbers among declined estate voters. I mean, that was really striking.
Mm-hmm.
Whitman, I think, was almost even, or maybe it was so striking that I can't remember them. But
and people under 35 who didn't know him.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Didn't have an opinion.
Yeah.
And then Democrats who said that they weren't necessarily happy with their choices. Though, again, the Brown people say voters are never happy with their choices. Anyway, I don't want to debate the spin.
Except in the 2008
presidential
election, they were pretty happy with their choices.
Yeah. But, that'll be one of those stories that'll be really – I mean, obviously it'll play out in 2010. But it's going to be fascinating to watch because, I mean, the national press will watch Jerry Brown. He's a well-known figure and icon in California politics. And as you found, and, you know, the rest of us, you know, certainly talk to people, who knows? I mean, it's not, you know, they're not all rushing up and with their arms up in the air cheering that
they're
he's
not.
The guy.
And he's going to have to give them a reason to do that, I think, sooner than later.
Agreed.
All right. So now that we've gone way long, does anybody want to make a prediction?
Maldonado confirmed or not?
Confirmed. And that goes against a bit of the conventional wisdom in the Capitol, which says the Democrats won't do it. I just have this feeling, and we'll play the tape back as soon as I'm wrong and they get rejected. But I've just got this feeling that the budget math.
I was just going
to
say.
The budget math is too big.
Yep.
The budget math is too big to walk away from Abel Maldonado's 27th vote in the Senate to get some deal. You're not going to get other Republicans to vote for a tax increase or a erasing of tax credits, which now has been floated, which, I mean, you know, those big corporate tax credits. And the only way you get Maldonado is to give him that job.
Yeah.
And
it's definitely going to be a part of the budget negotiations.
You're not doing a favor if you're Daryl Steinberg or Karen Bass, John Perez. You're not doing a favor to Alan Lowenthal, Dean Flores, or Janice Hahn, who are all running for lieutenant governor.
Lowenthal's not running.
Lowenthal's not running?
Not really.
So Flores and Hahn, you're not doing them a favor by giving Maldonado the job and letting him be the incumbent.
But they got to get a budget.
But the budget, I think, plays at the end of the day. Now,
you're
with me?
I guess
then?
I'm agreeing with you.
Are you?
Sort of.
You going out on a limb?
Yeah.
You know what? I think so, too. But we could all be wrong.
Right.
We could all be wrong. Although, you know, one thing is I spoke to the incoming speaker last week. He said he didn't think that there would be a budget vote before February 22nd.
Hmm.
So so this idea of trying to get one last vote out of Maldonado, apparently that's not going to happen. That's at least Perez's understanding that
Well, if that's the case, then I don't know where you get 27 votes in the Senate. I mean, maybe he can cobble them together in the Assembly. But
especially with the vacancy there. Yeah.
If you don't give Maldonado the job, because, I mean, I think if it doesn't happen by the time the budget happens, let me revise my
prediction. It's absolutely got to be part of the budget.
If it doesn't happen in an early budget negotiation, Maldonado doesn't get the job. Because then there's no incentive, I don't think, for Democrats to give him the job. So if it doesn't happen by then and the nuclear option happens and Maldonado, you know, angry then will never vote for a budget deal,
right,
then where do you find another vote in the Senate? I mean, among that really cantankerous Republican caucus.
I think you've got an upcoming race for the John Benoit seat, and I think that some Democrats think that Bill Emerson might be a place to get a vote on certain pieces of a budget.
They better be sending him a fruitcake than right now for the holidays.
Oh, I don't know. Would that help?
Maybe not a fruitcake. Something nicer. Sorry. Right. Fruitcake.
You know, there's Roy Ashburn, who we mentioned before. After that, I don't know, kind of slim pickings.
Any other predictions? Dun, dun, dun. We don't have to make
it. It'll be fun covering Jerry Brown. I mean, I'm hoping he does some quirky, unusual.
DeVore or Fiorina?
Ooh. Depends if Campbell gets in or not.
Ah,
Or Campbell.
Now, we're talking about US think Senate Campbell's going to win
but you
it.
Probably
but
knew that.
Right.
He would definitely change the dynamic of it.
I don't know. I think there's a lot more of the Fiorina story that hasn't been written. I think the more that reporters pour through the fear, she's going to spend an awful lot of time in 2010 defending her past. And that will be DeVore's opening. Whether or not he can take it remains to be seen, given his name ID is a lot lower. But she's going to play defense a lot more than playing offense, I think, in 2010. That might be as far as I'm willing to go on that. How about the big race? How about the Republicans? Whitman, Poizner, Campbell? Who are you going to tick off in what campaign that you say is
you
not
know,
going to
I mean, win? I just the Poizner campaign will make you believe that this campaign hasn't started yet. But I just don't see any reason to believe that Steve Poizner, as an elected official who has been working hard to cultivate the Republican grassroots. I mean, every poll I've seen has him in single digits. I have no reason to believe that that he can take out Whitman before June. I mean, if I had to call it now, I'd have to put money on Whitman.
Do you think Arnold Schwarzenegger endorses any Republicans?
No.
Not in the primary.
I mean, for governor, sorry, right? The rest of it, we'll just say because he doesn't really, whatever.
Yeah, but, I don't see it.
And will his non-endorsement be read as an endorsement for Jerry?
No, not necessarily. No. But I think you're going to see the Republican candidates running against Arnold Schwarzenegger. I mean,
of course.
You're going to see everyone running against Arnold
Schwarzenegger. Whitman has done a lot of that of late about talking about, you know, state worker trim backs and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Right. So. Yeah. And criticizing his budgets and spending and...
And in the end,
AB 32,
it all comes back. Well, global warming, yeah. But in the end, it all comes back to the budget.
It does.
Right? Another year of budget coverage.
Lucky us.
Let's pop the champagne. And let's just
yay.
Oh, yay.
Yay.
Anthony had too much eggnog last night. That's why he's not really thrilled about the champagne idea.
Hair of the dog. It's good.
All right. Well, Juliet Williams. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Crack reporter for the Associated Press in here to try to keep me in.
We have a majority of the Capitol Press Corps in here now.
We could pass some new rules if we had any power. So for Juliet and Anthony York from Capitol Weekly, I'm John Myers from KQED. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
See you next time.